Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Dr. James Emery White, who is the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church, or MEC, in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's a former professor of theology and culture at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, where he also served as their fourth president. Dr. White has authored more than 20 books, including Hybrid Church, The Rise of the Nuns, and my personal favorite, Meet Generation Z. One of the areas that you talk a lot about, and as I said, my favourite book of yours is Meet Generation Z. You've also written a fair bit about Generation Alpha. I'm yet to see the book come out, but you have written a lot about it on your blog. Would you just share a little bit about who are, let's take them individually because they are slightly different. Who are Gen Z and what are some of the defining features of Gen Z?
Right. Generation Z, they're called Z because we had already named one generation Generation X, and the next we named Generation Y. So, being really creative, sociologists began calling them Gen Z. And the years of their birth, you'll find some people in social science quibble a year or two, or pollsters a year or two, but essentially born between 1997 and 2012. As I wrote about, there were five major things that I think marked them. Their life has always been crisis marked. They have always known the internet. They've never known life without that. They are very naturally diverse in terms of their demographic and ethnic makeup. They are sexually fluid. And what I mean by that is that they tend to reject sexual labels. They tend to want to be amorphous that way, which is why you have such a rise in issues related to all things trans, and also people just wanting to just not be caught up in those kinds of labels. Mm-hmm. They want to reject all labels. And they're also the first generation that has been, raised or being unleashed in a post-Christian context. So those are five pretty significant marks that shape them in all kinds of ways that obviously I took time to unpack in that book, but those would be the headlines. Now, Generation Alpha is distinct. Their birth rates are essentially 2010 to this year. Most people are going to cut it off at the end of 2024 for Generation Alpha. They have some interesting marks too. They were raised by millennials, by and large. So if you want to understand Generation Alpha, you also need to understand some stuff about millennials. But one of the most important things is that's the generation that really started to be the rise of the nuns. Mm. So a lot of them were raised by nuns. They're kind of an online cohort. But the way they've been shaped by social media is different than Gen Z. They're TikTok versus Facebook. Mm. And we can talk about why that matters, because it does matter. TikTok's very different than Facebook, and the way it shapes you is different. But they've been TikTok. They were very influenced, deeply influenced by the pandemic and the isolation and the loss of school and many other things that swept the world. And they're influenced by influencers, which is a first. No other generation has had that kind of be a defining mark of their life. So, and when TikTok is that influencer, largely, you really do have something different.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, the difference between TikTok and Facebook, because I know you talk about millennials and Facebook versus Gen Z and Gen Alpha and TikTok. And it's you know, a lot of it is down to the pre-algorithm, post-algorithm. Would you just say a little bit about that why it's significant?
What you just said is what is significant, which is Facebook was pre-algorithm, which meant that what it did was it essentially exposed you to your network of friends and family. So that's, you know, it was a contained world, and it just linked you, exposed you to your friends and family. TikTok is an algorithm-based social media, so it exposes you to anyone and to everyone, and it can lead you, and it can manipulate, and it really is far, far, far more powerful. I mean, it's almost like a totally different animal, almost like a totally different effect and medium. And so that's the main difference, and it's a significant one.
I want to talk to you about the, you know, the impact of online, and I know you've written lots of great stuff about how we engage online, particularly for these generations, but you were saying that it's significant that we differentiate Gen Z and Gen Alpha from millennials because they are growing up in such a different culture. Would you just define some of the key differences and I guess why that matters between millennials and this younger generation?
Well, I mean, you can just look at it culturally by just when millennials were growing up and when, say, for example, Gen A is growing up or Gen Z. You know, if one generation, for example, can't imagine life without TV. Another generation, for example, can't imagine life without internet in your pocket. And so on and on it goes in terms of just how the cultural influences shape. I've made, and I'm not the only one, but I've really point a lot to the year 2007 as being a very significant year. And I'm not alone in that. Tom Friedman, who writes for the New York Times, has written many good books. But in one of his books, he had a chapter titled "What the H Happened in 2007." Only he, you know, what the heck? Only he didn't say heck. He said that was the year that the iPhone came out. You know, Facebook was spun off the campus. It's when Netflix started streaming videos. I mean, there's this list of all these things that happened in the year 2007 that changed our world. And so I really think that you can talk about millennials and Gen A and Gen Z, but I also think you can also talk about the world pre-2007 and post-2007, because in 2007 is really when, even though the digital revolution had already started and it happened, it was 2007 that it really entered our cultural world, you know, entered our cultural space.
Well, and Gen Z are currently the largest generation, and Gen Alpha are expected to be even larger. I think, you know, more than 2 billion among Gen Alpha. Why is that significant? And I guess, why does that matter for the rest of the generations as well? I suppose if someone is a millennial or older, they're sitting there thinking, why do I need to know anything about Gen Alpha and Gen Z? But they really do, don't they?
Oh, yeah, because the larger the generation, the more it influences culture. The more that everything is going to cater to that. I mean, the entertainment industry is going to cater to that. Technology, how we shop, tastes, music, everything is going to be shaped by that culture, because you either, at least from an economic standpoint, you cater to that culture or you die. And so you're always looking at the next generation, but also the largest generation, which is why even boomers, as they were older, were still a significant shaper, because culture was catering to them because of their sheer size. Well, when you look at the size of Gen Z and then the size of Gen A, you're just like, well, you know, that's going to be incredibly significant because it will shape culture and vice versa. You know, the best definition of culture that I know of is that it is the world which was the world into which you were born and the world which was born into you. And I think that you're going to have this interplay of Gen Z and Gen Alpha influencing culture and culture influencing them, obviously already through things like TikTok. But it becomes, you know, but you do have this is going to be the new mission field. I mean, so this is your mission field. And whenever I've talked with people who said, well, I don't want to worry about, you know, these younger generations. Well, then I get, you know, kiss your church goodbye. I mean, you're going to be a one generation and done. I mean, that's the future of the entire Christian movement. That's the future of every church. And I've long believed that as Christians, we're going to stand before God one day and give an account for this generation of non-Christians. And so if you don't care, then you don't understand the heart of Jesus and much less the responsibility that we have and the mission that we have. And so that's why I'm a student of culture, because I'm an old fashioned evangelist. You know, I hope that in the best sense of the word, meaning I'm a person who really does want to see someone far from God find God. I want to help people see how Christ can intersect the deepest needs of their life. I want them to experience the liberation of shame and guilt. I want them to come and see, come and hear, come and explore, come and experience what a relationship with the living God through Christ can mean. And it's very real. It's very vibrant to me. It's very pressing to me. And so that's why we study culture and study these generations and why we should care.
Having said all of that, why do you think we are seeing such a decline in the church among young people? That's not necessarily to say that they're not spiritual anymore, as we've already talked about, but we're clearly seeing huge droves of young people leaving the established church, okay, for want of a better word.
We need to quit blaming the young people. Okay. I think that we need to look at ourselves. You mentioned MEC and its size. Okay. We have over 20,000 active attenders. And we have skewed younger every year for the last 10, 15 years. The average person at MEC is in their 20s, maybe early 30s. We're just busting out with young people. 2/3 of our staff, maybe 3/4, are in their 20s of our staff. And it's led by someone who's 62 years old. So what gives with that? Well, the problem is that the church is not doing what it takes to connect intentionally, to reach out to these generations. It's like they don't even try. And I travel a fair amount. I speak at a fair amount, interact with a fair amount of leaders. And there's just an unwillingness. Either the leadership is not willing to make the changes needed. They're not willing to die to themselves to do what it takes to reach out. They're not willing to learn new things. They're almost like closet Luddites. They just refuse to even embrace anything new with technology. Or they're in structures that tie up the leadership gift so much that they can't do what they know to do and they would like to do to reach people. I was talking to, I mean, I could go on and on. I was talking with at a pastor's conference the other day, and I was talking to the pastor who's the pastor of the host church that we were at, and he said, you know, I really wanted to hang a couple of screens in here, the church, just so that we could maybe throw up the lyrics to some new songs that aren't in our hymnal, or just to throw up scripture when it's on there. And I said, you wanted to, I'm not understanding. He says, oh, it got voted down. We can't never have screens. Can't have screens. And I just was sitting there going, okay, that's such a stupid minor example, but it shows how ridiculous things are. I think that there's just so much that can be done. But yet even COVID, Ruth, when the church was forced to do so much that was helpful, relevant, important, church saving, the minute that ended, we went right back to business as usual and you know, left the greatest mission field that there is, which is online.
Mm. I really want to talk about that, because you've done some amazing stuff with MEC and online. But if we can just stay with young people for a minute, one of the questions, and this is massive, but how do we prioritize young people in our churches?
It's how you prioritize anybody. You know, just think about it. I mean, and think about it missiologically. If you want to reach 20 somethings, for example, it's no secret. You study them. What kind of music do they like? What style of music do they like? Well, you'll find that it's very eclectic. It's not one style. It's a lot of variety. But there are certain types of music that they like. Find out what artists they like. You find out how do they communicate. I mean, how do they want to get information? How do they want to be communicated with? Are they visual? Are they experiential? Find out the answers to those. So you can make stylistic differences. You can communicate with them the way they want to communicate. You can, like, for example, I mean, we all know, obviously, TikTok is for younger generations. If you were to ask them about Facebook, they'd say, well, that's for grandparents. So, I mean, you already know, then you're going to pick your social media differently and how you reach out to them. They have shorter attention spans. They do like variety in music, but there's certain types of music they like better than others and various artists. And so, if you say, well, you know, if you don't even know who, if I were to say, we talk about post-Christian, but do you know Post Malone? Mm-hmm. And they might say, who's that? Well, you might want to get to know some of these artists and the kind of music that they do. And then understand the nature of how to explain things and where their questions are. So it's not hard. It's just missiology 101. It's also another thing too, Ruth, is very important, is that I find a real hesitancy among churches to hire young staff in positions of significance and to platform them. And I've always felt that you attract who you platform. And so if you want a 40 to 50 something lily white church, then have a stage or staff littered with 50 something white men, you know, I mean, but if you want diversity, if you want men and women, if you want young, old and young, if you want white and black, then, you know, you're going to need to lead the way on that. And so MEC's young, it's diverse, with a young staff, and we're an integrated church racially and diversity, very, very diverse. And so, you know, but that was all intentional, and it takes intentionality.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
You've spoken so much about the importance of online, but how early are our young people now online? Because it's, again, skewing earlier and earlier, isn't it?
Well, I think that's driven by parents. I read something that in the UK that I think, I mean, you even have parents giving smartphones to five-year-olds, I want to be really gentle. So I would simply say that's insane. Insane. You'll hear parents say really, really dumb things like, oh, I'd never give my child a phone, but they have a pad. Mm. And you want to say, you do know that connects to the internet, right? So I would say that a lot of it is parent driven, but I think it is getting younger and younger and younger. And I think it's very rare to find like a 12-year-old without a phone. Mm. And so I do think that, and that it's also driving the exposure to pornography at ever increasing young ages, and also the way that they're influenced through these algorithm driven apps like TikTok, that makes them very influenced by influencers. And obviously that can be sketchy or hit or miss. So it is skewing younger. You're absolutely right.
So how do we protect our children within this pornified world? Because that is clearly a concern for many, many parents.
I don't know why more churches don't talk about this and teach on it. And like we have through the MEC Institute, one of our most popular classes is for parents about their kids in tech. And was written by one of our younger staff members, one of our younger pastors. and walks them through, okay, here's what phones do. Here's what pads do. I mean, it's not assuming you know a lot. Here's what these apps are. Here's what these, you know, here's how, here's what, when you download this software, it protects. Here's where it doesn't protect. Here's how kids can get around it. And, you know, and also just giving parents confidence and encouragement to limit screen time, limit what they have access to, that you're not being a bad parent if you do that. And if it feels like you're swimming upstream culturally, well, maybe that's a good thing. And so it's emboldening these parents. And so we have, that's one of the most popular classes. We just can't teach it enough. Mm. And it just packs out every time because, and the churches need to be one that's leading the way on this. And so I just think that we just need to, you know, realize that the role of a church includes helping our people think Christianly, act Christianly, parent Christianly, and intelligently in this culture. And that includes, obviously, with their children and their devices.
And so if you had any top tips for parents about how to navigate life in a world where porn really is readily accessible, is there anything you would say, any sort of top tips for parents?
We've got a mantra around here, and people here at MEC have heard me say this 1,000 times when it comes to parenting. You have got to be informed, involved, and in charge. Informed means you need to be aware of your child's world and know, you know, you've got to know, you got to be informed about what sites they're on and who their friends are and what's going on. You've got to be informed. You've got to be involved, present, active, part of it, a participant, not divorced from it, and involved in their world. And then third, and this is the one that parents just almost need the most help with, you're in charge. You're the parent, they're the child. That's the very nature of the parent-child relationship. Neil Postman wrote a book many years ago called The Disappearance of Childhood. It was prescient, where he was talking about the erosion of this thing called childhood, that we treat them like little adults. And I think that that's just sweeping our world right now. I actually like what's happening in the UK, where they're saying, look, I think it's ridiculous for an 8-year-old child to determine their gender independent of their parent, like they're a fully functioning mature adult, when the brain isn't even mature till it's 27. I mean, come on. This is ridiculous that we're doing this with children. We have to be in charge and be the parent. That's the very definition of childhood, that they're the immature and we're the mature. They need that parent. And so I think that when you tell parents, okay, look, be informed, be involved, and be in charge. Your goal is not for them to always like you. It's for them to always respect you. And you need to be the parent. You're not being bad when you're being a parent, which means telling a child no.
For many countries, this year, 2024, is an election year. How do you think young people are engaging with politics online?
It's really interesting. They're engaging with politics in a way that is different than it was. Rather than being letting a political, an aspiring politician tell them what their party wants to do, tell them their vision, tell them, you know, what needs to be done. Now, young people are looking for a politician that reflects them. Mm. And so they are very much expecting and wanting someone who will do two things. One, think, talk, act, and feel exactly like I do. And B, you're going to completely upend the system and radically change everything. And leading the way for that is often issues related to climate change. That's one of the leading issues. That and radical egalitarianism across the board. And sexually, racially, everything. But those are their issues. And that's really interesting to me, because this is something that's happening almost as we speak. The cardinal virtue used to be, particularly among younger generations, but really across our culture, was tolerance. Mm. Tolerance was the ultimate. That's giving way to intolerance and a judgmentalism that is saying, nope, my ideology is everything to me. My ideology on climate change or sexual identity or this issue or that issue. And so now there's more of a rigid intolerance in the name of this virtuous ideology that I hold, where because my ideology is perfect and it's so virtuous, it is virtuous for me to be intolerant of any other view and to even be hostile toward it and to penalize it. This is a shift. And so, I think it's being increasingly ideologically driven, and politics needs to reflect in their minds exactly what I want done and how I feel. You're not going to tell me anything. I'm going to tell you, and until my agenda is accepted. And it's really interesting how tolerance is thrown out the window for the virtue of ideology, and people's ideology is becoming their new theology.
Mm. So in light of all of that, is there any advice that you would give to young people voting? I'm not suggesting that you tell them which person to vote for, but are there things that you think young people should be considering with everything that's going on in the culture?
Yeah, we just did an entire podcast on the church and culture side on politics and you know, how you might want to vote, and how do you vote Christianly and things. And that was a more, you know, lengthy conversation, but I would just tell people, look, I mean, don't start with ideology, start with theology, and understand that I'm talking about in the American context, you're a Christian first, you're a Republican or a Democrat second, distant second. And if you are a Christian, you're going to find, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you're going to find that your party is not 100% in line with that. You may find that on creation care, one side gets it right. You may find that on maybe, immigration, another party gets it right in terms of a biblical worldview. But that's the key. What I'm finding among a lot of people, not just young, but all ages, is that they just buy into an ideology as a complete system. And they put their faith, their Christianity, their theology underneath it. And their theology almost gets critiqued by ideology, and they do confuse ideology with theology, and that becomes everything. And so they embrace things that no Christian should, but it's part of the ideological package. And so I would just encourage young people, look, don't become wed to any ideology. Be wed to a biblical worldview. Be wed to Jesus. Be wed to thinking Christianly about these things. And you're going to find that, that's going to be what needs to judge all ideologies, judge all political parties, including the political party you're a part of. And then once you're in that party, work for it to become more and more reflective of a consistent worldview that is in line with Jesus.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you so much, James. Now, there was a really moving post on your social media where you baptized one of your granddaughters earlier. I think it was in May, and she was one of 156 people being baptized that day. So it wasn't just her. But would you just share a little bit about what it was like baptizing your granddaughter?
Yeah, I'm a father of four, and all four of my kids had four kids. So I have 16 grandchildren. Three of my four kids are here in Charlotte and are involved in MEC. I have one daughter who lives in Tennessee, and her husband is a pastor. And her two oldest kids had already come to Christ and been baptized by him. This was the first time that I had a chance to opportunity baptize one of my grandchildren. And it was just amazing to me. But you're right. We have several baptism services a year. We had 156 we baptized that particular day, but in truth, every one of those lives matters to me. I don't think there's anything like seeing a life emerge from the waters of baptism and what it represents, and those people going forward in their faith. And the each story is so incredible as they talk about how they made that move and they came to faith and the people that were involved and what it all represents. And you hear marriages being restored and families strengthened and just lives just completely radically changed. And also with the understanding that, you know, baptism is not your arrival, it's your beginning point. And there's all kinds of transformation that is yet to come. And the Holy Spirit begins to work on you, but it's a wonderful, beautiful thing. And I never tire of it. And one of the things that I always like to remind people who are existing Christians is to say, look, don't ever let your baptism dry off. Mm. Don't ever forget what it was like before Christ. I think that's one of our problems. Don't ever forget what it's like before Christ. Don't ever forget where you were. Don't ever stop caring for the people who have yet to come. Don't ever dry off.
If you had, this might be really hard to whittle down, but you, if you had any top tips for reaching, let's do the generation separately, but if you had any top tips for reaching Gen Z, what would they be?
Well, I think they're going to be reached through social media. I mean, they are. That's how you're going to communicate with them. And so you have to learn, what does it mean to establish a presence on social media that is trusted? Because trust is huge. So how can you become a trusted voice that they might listen to? And that's going to be everything from, you know, things on YouTube and things that you post, and even how you might do digital marketing. And I think that, you know, that's, I mean, if you wanted one thing, you that's how they're going to be initially reached and the relationship built and forged and trust established.
And is there anything specific that you would also add for Gen Alpha?
So it's going to be the same thing, only on steroids.
Now, if there's any advice or words of encouragement that you could give directly to young people, is there anything you'd want to tell them?
You know, what I find is that there is a real, and again, I'm 62 years old, and I almost work exclusively with, you know, my church is a very young church. One of the reasons is that works is because I find that, and again, I don't mean this in a condescending way, but I mean, so many of these people have never been fathered, and they've never had a trusted spiritual mentor in their life, or someone that they felt was authentic, and that, you know, and wasn't abusive, and didn't have this deep shadow life that came out or something, where there was just a sense of, oh gosh, I would love to just learn some things or ask some things, and it'd be safe to do that. I find there's a hunger. And so what I would say to them is find some older, trusted people that love Jesus and find out why they love Jesus. And also really get at the real Jesus. You know, if you say there's a lot about the Christian faith that you don't like, and you don't like this about this and that, and I, you know, chances are I'm going to agree with you. But I'm also going to say, but that's counterfeit Christianity. That's not the real thing. That's not what it means to be in the Christ life. That's not what it means to follow Christ. That's not what the scriptures say. That is not what Jesus stood for. That's not the church. That's not the way it's supposed to, you know, and just helping people get past the baggage and the stereotypes and the caricatures and the raw ignorance, and then casting the vision where the Christian faith does hold to. I find that that's really what they're looking for and needing.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.